Call the Property Tax Division to order. Welcome all. I'm glad you made it safely on a slip-sliding kind of morning this morning on the commute. And I see one of our pages, but not the other at this point. So I think we'll wait a little bit to introduce our pages till they're both in the room. They're busy working hard getting us ready. But our first order of business is we don't have a quorum yet, so we will wait on approval of the minutes and a couple of other items. One of the things I wanted to let you know, I'll just give you kind of an overview of what to expect today. We're going to have staff go over the Minnesota property tax refunds. We covered them really briefly in the overview that touched on, you know, probably 20 or 30 topics. So we thought maybe you'd like a little bit refresher and a little more attention, because as you're aware, in the press and in our communities and in a variety of places and from our constituents, we're hearing about the challenges of affordable housing. And one of the major state contributions towards people being able to afford their housing, whether they're homeowners or renters, is our property tax refund programs. And we have some testifiers who would like to discuss that. And then we're going to hear a couple of bills, three bills today. We're going to start our official setting aside bills for possible inclusion in the omnibus division report. And for those of you who are new, we have some new members on the committee. Because we are a division of the full tax committee, what we do at the end is put together a bill that incorporates everything that we've decided should move forward and that fits within our budget target into a report that goes to the full tax committee, and then it is combined into the omnibus tax bill for the Minnesota House. So we won't have a bill that travels separately in the end. It will be handled by one tax conference committee that handles property taxes, local taxes, income taxes, the general sales tax, and lots of other things led by Representative Marquardt. And so that's just the motions here you'll find are a little different in some of your committees. It's always a motion to lay it over for consideration of inclusion in the property tax division report. And we now have quorum. So we are going to first introduce our pages. We have now final assignments, and we're delighted to have two gentlemen who are going to be helping us all term, and that is Benjamin Kristlinger and Stephen Abrams. And I've asked them to just briefly introduce themselves to the committee and where they're from, and welcome. Great. Welcome aboard. I would like a motion to reconsider approval of the minutes from January 14th. Yes, you recall at our last meeting we found out not everyone had that in their packet. So if I could have a motion to reconsider passage of the January 14th minutes, I would appreciate that.
So move.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. And now the January 14th minutes should be in everyone's packet, I hope. And I haven't heard of any consternation at that last meeting or this one. So all in favor of approval of the January 14 minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Thank you. The minutes are approved. And now I'd like a motion on the approval of the minutes from January 28th. Thank you, Representative Herr. And any questions or concerns? Otherwise, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. And with that, we're going to begin our overview of the Minnesota property tax refunds with Sean Williams from House Research. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Sean Williams from House Research. I'm going to briefly talk about the three property tax refund programs in the state, the Homestead Credit Refund Fund, the Renter's Property Tax Credit, and the Targeting Property Tax Program. So I'm going to start by talking about the Homestead Credit and Renter Refunds programs. Those are two of the three that I mentioned before. And is that better, Madam Chair?
Yes, it is.
Those two programs are the larger. So as you can see on this slide, there's about $634 million between the two of the programs, and the targeting refund program is significantly smaller than either of those. There's about 800,000 individuals across the state that claim the credits. The homestead credit refund is bigger in terms of dollar amount, so about $422 million claim the homestead credit refund versus $212 million claim the renter's refund. And it's also bigger in terms of number of claimants, although not by sort of the same amount. So about 472,000 individuals claim the homeowner's credit, and about 325,000 claim the renter's credit. The credit is calculated sort of according to a schedule, and I believe if you look in your packet, you'll have a copy of the schedule for both the homeowner's credit and the renter's credit. It might be helpful as we're sort of talking through the process of how this is estimated to take a look at that schedule. But essentially, there's three main components. There's a household income amount, which is the sort of what it's organized on. And then for each household income, you have a threshold that increases with income, a copay that increases with income, and a maximum. I'm going to go through a more detailed calculation later. But essentially, the threshold is a percentage of your property taxes. The copay is the amount above that threshold that a homeowner is expected to pay. And then the maximum is the maximum refund that's allowed. And hopefully, that makes a little bit more sense after we go through an example. The maximum household income eligible to receive the refund is $113,150 for refunds filed in 2019, and the maximum refund is $2,770 also for refunds filed in 2019. Those refunds are based on property taxes paid in 2019 and 2018 income. So you sort of, you're filing in the current year for property taxes, but it's based on your income from the previous year. So this example sort of shows four example individuals in different situations, two individuals in the metro area and two individuals in greater Minnesota. The estimates here are based on sort of what we think is about a median, and Mr. Swanson provided me with some data about sort of median home values in the metro area in greater Minnesota. So in the metro, we're talking about a $265,000 home. In greater Minnesota, we're talking about a $165,000 home. So you'll see that sort of reflected in the amount of property tax here. So you can see that these two individuals have the same, in both the metro area and in greater Minnesota, have the same amount of property tax assessed against their property, but different amounts of income. So on line two, you see taxpayer number one has $35,000 of income, and taxpayer one has $35,000, and taxpayer two has about $75,000. Part of the property tax refund formula is a deduction for dependents. So the amount, you start with sort of a broad measure of income. The law calls it household income. It's a little bit broader than even adjusted gross income. There's certain components of household income that are not even subject to federal taxation. But you do get dependents deductions. And then there's separate deductions in the formula for the number of individuals in your home over at the age of 65. And the number of individuals in your home that are disabled. So you can see that these two taxpayers both got, it looks like, two deductions there. The amount of, so that subtracting deductions from the gross income, you get the amount of household income for the purposes of the program. So that's the same for the two taxpayers in the two geographic areas, or for taxpayer one in each. You can see that the threshold percentage for each of them is different. So for taxpayer number one, because they have a lower income, the threshold of percentage is 2%. And for taxpayer number two, the threshold percentage is 2.1%. So the idea there is that the expectation is that when calculating a refund, sort of, we start with 2%. We start with the assumption that taxpayer one can pay about 2% of their property tax or income and property taxes, whereas for taxpayer two, because they have a slightly higher income, we start with the assumption they could pay 2.1%. So you multiply that threshold percentage times their income, and you get the threshold times income. That's on line six of the slide. So you compare that to sort of, and then you compare that amount to their property tax amount at the top. So I'm going to focus on taxpayer one for the purpose of walking through this example. That taxpayer has $483 is the threshold amount, and their property taxes are $3,500. So the property tax over the threshold is $3,017. The idea being this person has property taxes that are pretty high relative to their income, and that's the amount over the threshold. The next step is we assign for each taxpayer a copay percentage. So the refund program doesn't just say we're going to pay the whole amount above that threshold for the taxpayer. It instead says we're going to pay a certain percentage. And the 35% number is how much the taxpayer is expected to pay. So in this example, If you look at the copay amount, so you take the property tax above the threshold, that's the last line 7 on the previous slide, you multiply it by the copay percentage, and you get $1,056 for the first taxpayer in the metro area. So that gives you, that's how much that the taxpayer is expected to pay above the threshold. And then the remaining amount on line 10 is sort of the amount that the refund will cover. The next line, it just subjects it to a maximum, so none of the taxpayers in these examples are eligible for refunds above the maximum, but if the calculation had given them a higher amount, then they would be sort of limited the amount of that maximum. And so then on line 12, you sort of see the different refund amounts and how they vary. So taxpayer 1 gets a little bit more of a refund than taxpayer 2 in both geographic regions because that person had higher income, even though the property tax burden was pretty similar. And also both taxpayers in the metro area had higher refunds than in greater Minnesota because they had higher property tax bills. And the last line just shows you the amount of property tax that each individual would pay after taking into account the refund. So the renter's credit, if you look in your packet, there's another schedule similar to the per households, but this one is just for the renter's credit. It's the calculation is very similar. So the structure, it's using the same structure as the household schedule, except it's a different schedule for renters. For the purposes of the schedule, property taxes are just assumed to be 17% of the rent that the individual paid. So the landlord, for a renter, will provide that renter with a certificate of rent paid, showing how much that individual paid in rent. And then for the purposes of this refund program, they'd multiply that by 17%, sort of get their estimate of property taxes that's reflected in rent. I'd note that there's a 2017 report mandated by the 2017 legislature to sort of test if that's an accurate estimate of how much rent is constituted by property taxes. And the report, I think, generally concluded that there's some variation by geographic region, but overall 17% is probably a little bit higher than the data that the Department of Revenue had relative to the actual numbers for the amount of property taxes reflected in rent. For the renter's credit, the maximum refund for 2019 is $2,150. It also goes down with income, and the maximum household income is $61,320. And I would note that refunds claimed in 2019, this is a little bit different than the property tax refund, refunds claimed in 2019 for the renter's credit are based on the amount of rent you paid in the previous year. I'm not going to walk through this in as much detail as I walked through the homeowner's example because the calculation is pretty similar, but I think that the most important thing to see here is that, so on line 1, you get the monthly rent, so we're assuming for the metro area it's about $813 in monthly rent. It sounds like a pretty good deal to me for a one-bedroom apartment, but in this case, the annual rent for that person is about $9,756. And so you can see here there's that 17% multiplication occurring on line 3, where you multiply the rent that they paid times 17%, and that gets the estimate of rent constituting property taxes for the purposes of the property tax refund program. And then from there, the calculation is pretty much identical to the homeowner schedule. So unless there's questions from members, I'm not going to walk through that in the same amount of detail. So that's the renter's credit. The last program I'm going to talk about briefly is the targeting program. It's technically called the special property tax refund. So this program is different than the other two in that it's less based upon income. It's specifically targeted to homeowners whose taxes are increasing by more than 12% year over year. For the purposes of this program, like I said, household income is not considered. Your maximum refund is about $1,000. And I think this program is $3.1 million in 2017. There's about 36,000 returns that claimed it and an average refund of $85. So you can see that it's smaller both in terms of number of returns claiming it, it's smaller in terms of dollar amount, and then also in terms of average refund. The other thing I'll add is that in your packets, if you're interested in more information about these, we have sort of two-page documents from House Research that sort of give you some more detailed information about each of these three programs. So if you're interested in learning more, you can follow up with these publications or ask us questions after committee, or now's a good time.
Great. Does anyone have any questions for Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Sean, for your presentation, and great job on these handouts, by the way. Just wanted to ask you, the property, renter's refund, what percent is the actual today? Do we know what last year's numbers gave us from the Department of Revenue?
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I have the numbers in front of me, if you'll give me a moment. So it varied by geographic region, so they considered four different geographic regions. In the city of Minneapolis, it was about 16.1%. In the city of St. Paul, it was about 15.5%. In Anoka, Dakota, and then the parts of Hennepin and Ramsey County that weren't Minneapolis and St. Paul, it was about 13.4%. And then the rest of the state, it was about 12.9%.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Williams. So average for the state, if you average those, Mr. Williams?
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, that may be in the report for a statewide number, but I don't have that offhand. I'm happy to email it to you.
Thank you. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question, and could you, and it's, I'm full disclosure, it's prepping for my next bill that's being heard, but are there any forms of property tax refunds in Minnesota of land owners who cannot get a property tax refund?
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, I think keeping in mind the bill that you're mentioning here, I think that there are certain cases where manufactured park owners who are in cooperatives don't get credit for their ground lease payments. And I think that that's sort of the issue that maybe that
right,
you're raising in your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to highlight that they're the only ones that don't get that opportunity. So thank you.
Thank you. And Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. See, in regards to last year, I recall hearing from several of my constituents, some that were above 65, who fit the whole criteria and were eligible for the refund but didn't receive it. I then made a call to the Department of Revenue, and they were able to help some of them, but I think there was one or two that didn't receive it. Was there any reason why? Are you familiar with what some of the hiccups were last year?
Mr. Williams?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I'm not familiar. I don't know if the Department of Revenue can comment more specifically if there are specific administrative issues last year, but I'm not aware of the details of those, if there were.
Thank you. And one of the things I'm going to point out, if you look at the Minnesota House Research Homestead Credit Refund Program summary, it starts by saying it was previously known as the Homeowners Property Tax Refund Program, or PTR. I still hear PTR all the time. It's sometimes called the circuit breaker because it's of the way it has adjusts based on income and property values. Under the special property tax refund, it's commonly referred to targeting. And one of the things I'm thinking about is we ought to settle on a name on these and start. It's hard enough to learn all these different programs, let alone having each one have three aliases that just seem to live on forever. But it does make, I think, this a little more confusing for people when they're trying to figure out what can they apply for and how do they find the information about it if we're not all using the same language, especially when everybody looks everything up on Google, on the web, and if you put in the wrong term, it might not show up, even though you might qualify. And with that, we have some testimony on the Property Tax Refund Program and its impacts. And first, we'd like to welcome Paul Eager from the Minnesota Realtors. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Eger. I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors. We're a statewide trade association with over 20,000 real estate professionals as our members. I want to just thank you for the opportunity to testify on the Homestead Credit Refund Program. I'm still a PTR person, so I'll try to use the actual name, Madam Chair, but I may slip throughout my testimony.
Mr. Eager, your suggestion on a permanent name is always open.
Well, I'm going to suggest property tax refund because that's what I'm accustomed to. But, Madam Chair, I want to start by echoing something that you said at the beginning of this meeting as well as at your meeting last week, and that this is an important program in terms of making home ownership more affordable and actually just affordable home ownership and rental units across the state, and we concur with that statement. I won't cover the territory that Mr. Williams covered in his presentation, but it gives you, he gave a great sense of the value of this program and how it works. I would add maybe just one piece of data from the Department of Revenue's 2017 tax incidence study that, quote, the property tax refunds offset 12% of the residential property tax burden, which is down from 12.4% in 2014. And the refunds offset a much higher portion in the lowest five deciles. So there's some really good data that the Department of Revenue has assembled that shows the value of this program. But I want to focus the majority of my testimony, which was very brief, on just some of the strengths of this program in terms of the ability for policymakers, everybody in this room and in the full tax committee, to increase your support for homeowners. And this program has a lot of different moving pieces, and all of those pieces can be modified by the legislature to increase support in various ways. For example, you could increase the maximum refund. You could decrease the copayment percentage. You could lower the threshold percentage for determining eligibility. And finally, you could also increase the household income for eligibility. So these are all options, and the legislature has made modifications from time to time throughout the years to increase support for certain people that qualify for the homestead credit refund program. And finally, Madam Chair, and this came up just a second ago, I think any discussion that the legislature can have with involving the Department of Revenue and other stakeholders to figure out more effective ways, additional ways that we can get the word out to homeowners and renters that would otherwise qualify for this program but just may not hear about it. I think that's a worthwhile discussion to have. And finally, Madam Chair, just thank you for the opportunity to provide some brief comments and for taking up this topic today.
Thank you very much for coming and sharing your thoughts. Next, we have Michael Dahl from Homeline. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michael Dahl. Members of the committee, I'm the Public Policy Director with Homeline, a statewide tenant advocacy organization. Our primary service is to the statewide hotline that offers free and confidential legal advice to Minnesota renters, to any Minnesota renter. Because of the nature of the hotline, we hear a great deal about the issues and trends affecting renters. And the property tax refund is one of the top priorities for our clients. I'm here today to speak to the value of the renter's credit. As you will soon see, the renter's credit is targeted tax relief for households that need the credit. Minnesota tenants use the renter's credit to buy basic necessities while also putting money back into local economies, which has a secondary useful benefit. But to begin with, I'd like to share a few facts about Minnesota's housing situation, particularly for renters, which should help you understand why the renter's credit is so important. As noted by the Minnesota Housing Partnership's 2017 report, The State of the State's Housing, rents are far outpacing renters' income. The median rent has risen by 9% since 2000, while the median renter income has fallen by 11% during that same time frame. Secondly, needed affordable housing is unavailable. For every 100 extremely low-income families, there are only 36 units that are available and affordable housing for that population. And third, the most in-demand jobs do not pay a living wage. Workers in four of the six most in-demand jobs cannot afford a rent of two-bedroom apartment. In other words, renters are feeling a daunting and acute crunch on both sides of both the price and availability of rental housing. And the job prospects makes it difficult for renters to see a way forward. The renter's credit tax refund is one of the most effective ways to achieve relief that renters of low income need. And I'd like to devote the rest of my time to what Homeline has heard from renters over the years from Minnesota, the Minnesota tenants use the renter's credit for. I want to put an exclamation point on this. The renter's credit is really used for basic necessities for renters. The renters have let us know what it is they use the renter's credit for, and it's a number of basic necessities, as I said. First, we've been told people use things for laundry, cleaning supplies, toothpaste, toilet paper, soap, and other toiletries. They pay for pocket, out-of-pocket prescription costs, as well as over-the-counter medicines and drugs. They buy, they get caught up on their prescription eyewear and dental expenses not covered by insurance, and they buy school supplies and clothing for school. And I want to note that, as you all know, the renter's credit is well-timed for families with children because the renter's credit comes mid to late August when households are preparing for a start to school. Renters use the renter's credit to do maintenance on their automobiles and their license tabs, their insurance, and other transportation costs like Metro Mobility, especially for seniors who keeps them mobile and able to keep to the doctor visits. Renters use the renter's credit to stock up for groceries over winter, and they buy winter boots and other seasonal clothing needs. In fact, what this is saying is that these are one-time things people can buy and use the renter's credit to be able to catch up on things that they don't have otherwise. Representative Marquardt, I'd like to end with my testimony with one of your constituents, someone that you may remember from years ago. His name was Robert. Robert is someone who wrote to us very specifically about what he used the renter's credit for, and I want to share with you once again what he said. First of all, he said he used the renter's credit to address medical needs. He bought some new clothes and shoes. He had special eyeglass needs. He had stationery supplies, food and related spices and herbs, 20 Christmas cards, postage supplies, and he also helped pay for a senior waiver. What stuck with me in this conversation with Robert, or this note from Robert, is that he noted specifically about herbs and spices. And so our staff had a conversation with him specifically about that. And Robert told us he loved it when stores sold ramen in bulk, and that having herbs and spices allowed him to double the water content of the ramen noodles. To me, it's shocking that what was being used to fill up Robert's stomach was twice the water content in ramen noodles. And it's just never left me, and it's been a story that I've carried with me ever since I first heard it. Minnesota tenants need the renter's credit. They value the renter's credit and how it helps them buy basic necessities. And as I said, low-income renters are more apt to spend these resources, so the money cycles throughout the local economy. I want to ask that you please do all you can to protect the renter's credit. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify. And, of course, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about the value of this credit for the renters that speak to us. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And seeing no questions, we'll go to the next testifier, which is Ann Krisnick from the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. Thank you for illustrating what people use it for. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ann Krisnick. I'm the Executive Director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, which is made up of the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. We represent faith communities and people of faith across Minnesota. I think most of what our people see is exactly what our members see is exactly what the testimony was that you just heard, that for many low and moderate income Minnesotans, the property tax refund, in particular the renter's credit, are really financial lifelines. And we hear in our parishes and our synagogues and our mosques about people who are struggling even though they're working full-time, people who are cobbling two or three jobs together to try to provide for themselves and for their families. And we see these people delaying repairs that they need. We see them accruing medical bills that they can't cover with the amount of money they're getting from their paychecks, and they're really struggling to provide for their families. For many families and individuals, these refunds are one of the major financial events of the year. They know what the amount is that they're expecting. They plan their budgets around those. But they allow these low and moderate income Minnesotans to address long-term needs that they needed to put off. That's often repairs to their home or to a vehicle. It allows them to pay off or pay down bills that they weren't able to cover with their regular paychecks. And many of them use it, as was stated earlier, for just basic needs. They're using it for a monthly rent or mortgage payment, or they're using it to buy shoes for their children or cough medicine or diapers. These funds are a really important part of the financial health of many individual Minnesotans and also of many Minnesota communities. So we just urge you to protect and strengthen the renter's credit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next we have Nan Madden from the Minnesota Budget Project.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a handout if the pages could help me with that.
They'd be glad to.
Thank you. So thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. The Minnesota Budget Project is a research and advocacy initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We identify and promote public policies to expand opportunity and economic security to all Minnesotans, regardless of who they are or where they live. And we focus on tax, budget, and economic policies and their impact on low and moderate income Minnesotans. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today about the renter's credit. Like all Minnesotans, Minnesota's renters want safe, affordable homes for themselves and their families. But as you've heard, some Minnesotans earning low wages or on fixed incomes struggle to afford the cost of housing and other basic necessities. The renter's credit seeks to limit how big a share of a household's budget can go towards paying property taxes. It refunds a portion of the property taxes that renters have paid through their rent. It is well targeted to Minnesota's most struggling households, and a substantial majority of those who receive the credit have household incomes around $31,000 a year or less. We also know that more than one quarter of households who receive the renter's credit include senior citizens or people with living with severe disabilities. This percentage tends to be higher in Greater Minnesota, and there are 12 Greater Minnesota counties where at least half of the households who receive the renter's credit include seniors or people living with severe disabilities. And the handout I provided includes information for every Minnesota county about the folks who receive the renter's credit. I'd also just like to echo what you've heard from other testifiers about the difference that the renter's credit makes in people's lives. And we've heard similar stories over the years about just the really basic everyday expenses that people can buy when they get that refund back in the fall. This session, we would encourage you to protect and strengthen the renter's credit. First of all, we'd ask you to protect the renter's credit as you make your decisions about federal conformity. If we conform to the federal tax bill just straight up, that would result in a $34 million cut to the renter's credit because it would eliminate the exemption that exists that provides a larger refund for seniors, people with disabilities, and families with dependents. And I know there was bipartisan support for maintaining that exemption last year, and I appreciate the work of the committee on that. In terms of strengthening the renter's credit, as Mr. Egger mentioned, there's a number of parameters in the calculation for the renter's credit, so there's a number of ways you could go about strengthening the credit. You could address the marriage penalty that exists when there's two members of the household that are seniors or people with disabilities, but right now they only get one subtraction, and I want to thank Representative Marquardt has worked on this issue in the past. You could increase the maximum credit amount, which would benefit the folks for whom the property tax makes up an especially high share of their incomes. You could provide larger refunds by reducing the copayment component of the formula for calculating the refund. And you could also consider taking family size more into account by increasing the exemptions for families with dependents. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I look forward to working with the committee this session on the renter's credit. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have a question from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's really more of a comment as we finish up with this portion than it is a question. And it seems like we're hearing more and more about people that are low-income, especially renters, and those low-income housing, how this particular property taxes are impacting them negatively and how they're really looking forward to the refund for that. And it seemed to some degree, to make sense that if we hadn't collected such high taxes, they wouldn't have to have the refund, and we certainly, they would have had that fund throughout the year. And so it really does exemplify that this particular issue is certainly regressive as well, and I'm glad we're working to really consider how it impacts everybody and how we deal with it, because we take it in taxes in one hand and then give it back in another. That always leads to inefficiencies. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for that comment. Thank you for your comments, Ms. Madden. I do think this is an area that hasn't had any change for, I think, since 2013. And we all know that housing costs, property taxes have gone up, generally more than people's wages have gone up. Economists are puzzled as to why we aren't seeing more wage growth given things, various factors that have been happening in our economy. And so this is an area that I think we're going to want to look at more seriously once we have a budget target for our committee as to what our possibilities are and where we want to target it. And so I appreciate the committee spending some time thinking it through and getting familiar with the components of it. And with that, we're going to take up our first bill, and we have Representative Connie Bernardi, a member of our committee, to present House File 458. Welcome. You can begin while they're just still handing out the revenue estimate and some background material.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 458 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you. Why don't you tell us about your bill?
Okay. Thank you very much. This bill, it helps the shareholders of manufactured home parks cooperatives to include their ground lease payments when filing for homestead credit state tax refund. This is the only group of people in Minnesota that are treated differently than other people. And if they were not a cooperative, they would already be able to get this treatment. It affects over 600 households living in 8 manufacturing housing cooperatives throughout the state. This is a bipartisan bill. Representative Lean, Representative Gunther, Representative New, Representative Bennett, Representative Munson, Representative Salk, and Representative Haley are all on the bill with me. And representatives, you're all welcome to join us. This bill has been contained in 2 House tax bills, and it was last year's veto tax bill. So it's had bipartisan support, as I mentioned, and it continues to. This will allow taxpayers living in these cooperatives to claim the property taxes paid on the land beneath their homes to be calculated when computing and applying for a refund. Currently, these individuals are the only category of property taxpayers who cannot secure a refund on the property taxes paid on their land. Manufactured housing is very affordable ownership. The current tax treatment is the contributing factor and disincentive for other parks to become resident-owned and thus permanently preserved communities. This revenue note is $220,000 per year. The attached handout that you received is that they're not being treated fairly. You'll be able to see how that stands out in that chart. And restoring these homeowners' ability to apply for renter's credit would treat them on par with other property taxpayers. I have 2 witnesses with me today who can address the issue in more detail. Natividad Seafeld, resident and president of Park Plaza Cooperative in Fridley, Minnesota, and Sean McLenhattan. He's the North Country Cooperative Foundation, which has assisted in the conversion of these parks into renter-owned communities. I'm so proud to have, come on up, so proud to have one of my constituents here who has been working very hard with the residents in her community to make this an amazing park and really to have safety and security with their new storm shelter that's been built, and she will convey the importance of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and committee members, my name is Natividad Seafeld. I am president of Park Plaza Cooperative and have been for the past almost 7 years. In 2011, we signed the papers and became a cooperative and married our land to our homes and secured our property to where we will not be displaced ever again. In doing so, when the first year came up to give everyone their forms that said you're getting a rent credit, I was the one who had to put a zero on it and hand it to them and then try to explain why. I myself can understand that, but when you have residents who are waiting and counting on that money, it was very hard and very heartbreaking. Since then, we've still done the same, and we live across the street from a community that houses about 400 to 500 homes who gets the rent credit, and we still do not. I will mention a few names and try and put their faces in words to you. The first one is Barbara Urich, age 80, has lived in our community for a very long time. I'm asking her what she did with her property tax. Car insurance, house insurance, property taxes if needed, and fixed any small items around the home. John Duffy, age 50 to 60 years, he did the same, home repairs, and his biggest deal was to make sure that he got some food. Benita Johnson, age 85, she has lived there 19 years. She does home repairs that are small, buys toilet paper, light bulbs, and food. Francisco and family, three children, ages 40, both parents work, counts on that money to pay another house payment, another mortgage payment of sorts, and food. And one of the commonalities between all the residents in the community, the biggest thing was food. Not everyone is able to get help from the county. Mara Hernandez, a single mother, in her 40s, three children, home repairs, school supplies, school clothes, and food. Anthony, three children and a bunch of grandchildren, ages 40. Husband works, wife stays home, catch up on bills, and buys food. Daryl Dahl, in his 50s, home repairs, and one of his biggest dreams would be to go on a fishing trip on the ice in an ice house for 2 days. So it's really hard to be the president of a community that works super hard to make sure things are safe, secure. We're never going to be displaced. We worked really hard in getting our storm shelter in the last 2 years, which is still being built. We're almost there, and everyone can come see it. We've worked really hard on infrastructure. We put $1 million into our infrastructure without raising the rent. Until this year, we had to raise the rent $6. We weren't able to get some homes to fill empty lots. We had to raise it another $7. So $13 in 3 years. This is how secure our cooperatives make our families. So we ask if we can please be added to the bill and be fair like everyone else in the communities around us and the whole state who gets renter credit, and we do not. I thank you for inviting me and allowing me to speak upon this.
Thank you, Ms. Seafeld, and welcome to the committee, Mr. McElhutton.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean McElhutton. I'm the Senior Development Director for North Country Cooperative Foundation. We're a Minnesota-based nonprofit organization that helps residents of manufactured home communities like Natividad and her neighbors to organize, negotiate an arm's length of purchase agreement for the communities in which they live, finance and buy the parks, and then operate them. Manufactured housing is a very important workforce housing resource in the state of Minnesota. There are over 800 communities in Minnesota containing about 50,000 households. And as Representative Bernardi pointed out, all of those residents, of those 50,000 residents, except the residents in the eight resident-owned communities, about 600 households, are entitled to claim the renter's credit. In the work that we do, so it's an important housing resource, but it's one that is disappearing at an alarming rate. The last several years, we've lost nearly 1,000 units of workforce housing in manufactured home communities to closure. Often it's a rational economic decision for the owner of the community to close it and redevelop the land for another purpose. But when residents are able to buy their communities, they can prevent that loss of housing because they're not going to use it for any other purpose. It's their home. But in encouraging residents to purchase their communities, not being entitled to the renter's credit is an impediment because that is such an important source of revenue for many of the households. And when we have to tell them, you know, you can buy this community, but if you do, the renter's credit goes away. Again, that's a strong disincentive for people to take charge of their lives by purchasing the parks. So I'd encourage you all to support House File 458, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg had a question earlier.
Yeah, thank you. And this is more of just a clarified question in regards to just tax rates and so forth. And I'm not sure, Madam Chair, if Chair Bernardi or testifier or staff can tell. It seems to me in previous years when we discussed this, there was some difference or variation in the tax rate for investor-owned versus co-op-owned property tax rates. Am I correct in that, or was that something that I just didn't understand?
Mr. Swanson, can you assist us with this?
Madam Chair and Representative Petersburg, so I believe what you're referring to are the classification rates.
Right.
So typical manufactured home parks for our net tax capacity system have a classification rate of 1.25%, but owner-occupied co-ops have two different rates that they could potentially have. So if the park is less than 50% owner-occupied, those parks will have a classification rate of 1%, and 50% or more owner-occupied has a classification rate of 0.75%.
Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. And I think that was kind of what I remembered, is that they were, that their tax that they paid on their rent and so forth was less than that 17% that the others were there. And that was some of the reason why they were treated a little bit differently. And so I just would say if that's the case, we just need to keep that in mind as well, that is part of the trade-off also, because otherwise they'll get actually better treatment than other people in other mobile homes. So just food for thought.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sure. My question was very similar to Representative Petersburg, that their tax rate, property tax rate, were lower than other homeowners. Was that your point? Yeah. And what is that rate difference then from a homeowner as a residential home of a single family than that of a mobile home? Do you know what that rate is?
Mr. Swanson, any further information?
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, so for a residential homestead, it depends on the market value of the home, but for anything under $500,000, that class rate is 1%, and then over $500,000, that class rate is 1.25%. So manufactured park co-ops are either, depending on the percent owner occupancy, are either the same as a residential homestead or slightly lower.
Thank you. And this is the first.
Oh, Madam Chair, I just want to point out that in exchange for the lower tax rate, the residents gave up the market value credit. So that was the trade-off for the lower class rate.
Thank you. That's some additional information. And, Representative Hurtas, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the new members on the committee, we struggle year after year after year with the complexity of our property tax system. And here's another good example of where we could start to collapse some of the classifications and the rates. But that said, my question is, and I don't know if the testifiers would have any data on this, but, and again, rents are specific as to location, but do you have any comparison of what owner-owned cooperative rental rates are for renting to themselves their own lots versus the investor type of mobile home parks? What are the rents typically? Is there a comparison?
Mr. McElhatter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I don't have any data, but when the residents purchase the park, they pay a market value, and so they need to maintain. Typically, they have to increase their rents by 10 to 15% to be able to afford the purchase. And there's a wide variety of rates in communities across the state of Minnesota, but the rates in resident communities are comparable to investor-owned. But since the residents only raise the rents as their costs increase, the rents tend to drop below market rate over a period of time.
Thank you. That was very helpful. The other thing I'll point out is that in your packet, a follow-up, sorry, Representative Hirschhaus.
Thank you. And Representative Bernardi, thanks for carrying this bill again. Here's an example, too, where I know we've tried to address this issue with regard to agricultural homesteads when the cooperative owned by the family owns the property and how we treat homestead application. And here's a situation that's parallel to that, where we have the owners own the cooperative, and maybe another way to at least search a possibility is to allow those folks that are renting from their own cooperative that they can file a full homestead, because they really do own land under the rental unit.
Thank you. One of the handouts you'll note is your Minnesota Department of Revenue has a revenue estimate. And since this is the first bill we're seeing, Ms. Schill suggested that she just very briefly explain how this is laid out, because we'll be seeing these frequently with the bills as we consider them.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The revenue estimate, and Representative Bernardi referred to it, it looks like this. And if you look at the top left-hand corner, it has the emblem of the Department of Revenue. And that's important because the only official estimates that we receive and track and show up on our tracking sheets are from the Department of Revenue. If you look down immediate below, you'll have the date when the revenue estimate is made. That is also important because we will have a forecast update at the end of this month, February 28th. And so right now this revenue estimate is February 1st, and that's the best knowledge that we have at this time, but it will require an update after we receive the February forecast. So take that as a bit of advice. If you look to the right, you'll see the title. It says property tax refund. This is one of the several different areas in which we can identify pretty quickly what the issue is contained in the bill. And then below that, obviously, you'll see more specific information. There is a box immediately below that. That is also important because it is something that I take to heart when it's asked the question whether this has an administrative impact. Now, if you recall, when we went over very quickly revenue estimates at the briefing session at the beginning of this division set of meetings, we talked about how we use revenue estimates as an impact of revenues for a general fund or other funds in the state. The DOR administrative costs are reflected through a fiscal note. And so when I see little yes box checked here, that is a trigger to also ask the question, what will it cost to administer this change in law? And that would, so you would have two elements, the revenue estimate and the fiscal note, as what the total impact would be of a suggested bill change. Going further on down, you'll see Department of Revenue. This is the analysis that will give the bill number and the member and the version that we're looking at. If, for example, we had an amendment, and we'll take a look at the next couple revenue estimates that this committee will look at, that's also important because it'll give you an idea if you're which version of the bill you're looking at. Moving on down, you'll see General Fund, and we typically have 4 years reflected in a revenue estimate. The first 2 years are the biennial budget year for which we'll have targets, and that's for this session, fiscals 20 and 21. We also do two additional years, which are called the planning years, and so it'll give a better sense of what the overall impact over a four-year time period is. One other point before we get to the explanation of the bill, the effective date is always listed right below there. So, and that is important because effective dates will impact the magnitude, that's the best way to describe it, the magnitude of the fiscal effect of the revenue change. Then you get into the explanation of the bill, and Department of Revenue is really very good on this in the sense that it'll give you a brief synopsis of what the current law is and then compare the proposed change in law. And then you'll have further revenue analysis detail, including some of the things that Representative Bernardi mentioned in this particular one for House File 458. It'll give information on who is affected, over what time period, and what other assumptions that would be included in devising this revenue estimate. So for this revenue estimate, and what I usually ask to do is to give you the impact for fiscal 2021, which would be a cost. Okay, that's one more thing here. These revenue estimates are presented in terms of revenue gain or revenue loss. And so when you see in parentheses the $220,000, they're always in thousands, that means there is a revenue loss of $220,000 over the 2021 biennium and then $440,000 in the planning years 22 and 23. When we start tallying things that would be included, for example, in a division report, I need to reflect these, how much they cost. So you'll have kind of this shift over when I go to the spreadsheet. I'll have to include that positive numbers are an expenditure increase and negative numbers are a cost savings. So you'll see some things as we tally up things, it'll just look a little bit different. So if you have any questions on how that's happening and what's going on, please come see me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And seeing no further discussion, Representative Bernardi renews her motion that we lay over this bill for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you so much to you and your witnesses.
Thank you.
And next, we will have Representative Vang take over the chair as our vice chair so I can present to the last two bills, and hopefully we'll get through both of them, but we'll see. Thank you. This is the first and perhaps not the last bills authored by the leaders of all three political caucuses represented in our committee. And just to give you an overview of both of these bills, they are both bills that were a collection of bills that were heard in the last term, were favorably acted on within the committee, and became part of the final tax bill that ultimately was vetoed. And so that's why they're back before us. We had asked our nonpartisan staff to look at all that was included and to pull out just those things that in their perspective and from their memory of the hearings last year were non-controversial. And so that is our goal. Many of these things came from individual members. Some of them came from the Department of Revenue. It's a collection that has a variety of sources, but we thought it would be good to kind of clear the deck on some things that on a bipartisan basis last term were considered worthy of moving forward. And with that, I would like to move our first bill, which is House File 632. This one is focused primarily at no-cost items, although sometimes we see things with insignificant costs, things that might have evolved into a minor cost item. But in general, these are not things that we'd need to deal with. And I've asked Alex Hagler is going to take what's Jared's name is listed, but Alex is going to cover the first part of the contents of this, and we're just going to kind of give you briefly some overview of what's in this bill. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam.
Excuse me, Chair Loeffler. First, would you like to move your bill to get
yes.
It's for possible
presenting
inclusion?
My first bill this term, I should move the author's amendment, the A2 amendment, which is in your packet. And what this does is it changes a couple of effective dates, and it deletes some minor cost items and puts them back into House File 567, which is the next bill, which we tended to try and cluster the cost items together.
Chair Loeffler, I think the question was, would you like to move your House File 632 for possible inclusion in the division report?
Yes, I would like to move House File 632 for possible inclusion and to incorporate the author's amendment A2.
And then would you explain your amendment, please?
And as I mentioned, it just changes and updates the effective dates and takes out some sections that will reappear in House File 567 so that our cost items are clustered together in the same bill.
Any discussions? Hearing none, those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All right, the motion prevails. Those opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. To the bill, Chair Loeffler.
Thank you, and now I think we'd like to just go through the base bill, and I understand there may be another issue that's brought forward after this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to go through Article 1 section by section to give you all a brief overview of what the provision is doing for those who may not remember from last year. So Section 1, the County Historical Society, this section allows a city or town to fund its own historical society from its property tax levy. Currently, cities and towns can only fund the county's historical society. Sections 2 and 3 go together, and these sections authorize a county veterans service officer to share information with the county assessor for the purpose of making eligibility determination for the disabled veterans homestead exclusion. And in the 2017 tax bill, the annual application requirement for the exclusion was eliminated, and instead required the county veterans service officer to certify the disability status of current beneficiaries each year to the county assessor to make the eligibility determination. However, there was no explicit authorization to allow the sharing of the private data, so the 2017 provision can only be administered if a veteran consents to the release of their private data. And so these sections are just allowing the information to be exchanged more freely and to administer the new provision without having to obtain a release form. Section 4, duties of the commissioner after sale. This section amends a provision related to the issuance of state deeds for sales of tax forfeited land. Currently, the county auditor must apply to the commissioner of revenue for a state deed after a sale is complete and must certify that all money related to the sale of the property has been collected. This provision allows the county auditor to request a deed prior to the sale, as well as provided that a closing agent, title insurer, or title insurance agent confirms that the money for purchase is currently held in escrow. It also clarifies that the conveyance is not effective until recorded. Section 5, that's titled Restriction, is technical cleanup language restricting the types of property that can qualify for border city enterprise zone tax reductions. It makes clear that a restaurant that has a franchise agreement requirement to establish in Minnesota is not eligible to receive tax benefits. Sections 6 and 8, titled Till Expiration, these excuse me. Section 6 through 8 authorize the immediate withdrawal of land enrolled in the Metro Ag Preserve when a state agency or other government unit acquires the land or obtains an easement for the land for the purpose of creating a public trail or park. When property owners enroll in the Ag Preserve program, they enter into covenants that restrict them from using the land for non-agricultural purposes. And thus, once the land is acquired by the government unit, the land no longer meets that restriction. And so these provisions allow the acquired land to expire from the program without affecting the rest of the land. Section 9, the Northwest Minnesota Multi-County HRA. This provision allows the HRA to levy for 5 more years. It is a special taxing district, and every 5 years, the HRA requests the ability to levy for the following 5 years. And that is the first line of the amendment is just updating those dates of the A2 amendment. Section 16 is about the SFIA program, and this program is just this provision is just technical cleanup language that amends the effective date to an SFIA provision enacted by the 2017 bill that amended the definition of forest land to include land improved with a paved trail under an easement, lease, or license to the state or other political subdivision. And the effective date change here clarifies that the land improved with the paved trail at the time an SFIA enrollee submits their annual certification. It meets the new definition of forest land that was amended in 2017. So that is all for Article 1.
All right. Thank you. I believe we have testifiers from the Department of Revenue to walk through Articles 2 and 3 of the bill. Please identify yourself and who you represent for the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Kyle Gustafson. I'm a staff attorney with the Department of Revenue, and I will be walking through the provisions in Article 2. These are all items that were contained in the department's 2018 policy bill. First of all, Section 1 clarifies that the Commissioner of Transportation will certify aid amounts for the Small Cities Assistance Aid Program to the Commissioner of Revenue by June 1st. This is just putting current practice into statute. Section 2 would specify that the Commissioner of Revenue make recommendations to the Board of Assessors for sanctions and clarifies the notice and hearing procedures for an applicant or a licensee who disputes Commissioner's recommendation. I do want to note that although the department carried this in its 2018, or put it forward in its 2018 policy bill, the department does not intend to do so this session, as the department and the Board of Assessors are exploring the best way to carry out its functions for overseeing the practices of licensed assessors. Section 3 increases the threshold amount of consideration in a real estate transaction that triggers the need for buyers and sellers to file a certificate of real estate value, and it increases that threshold amount from $1,000 to consideration in excess of $3,000. And then related to that, in Section 4, this provision would raise the threshold amount that is subject to the minimum deed tax for the consideration in a real estate transaction, and that would increase the amount of value that or a transaction where the minimum deed tax will apply from transactions that are under $500 to transactions that are $3,000 or less. Both sections 3 and sections 3 and 4 were provisions that the department worked with counties on over the last couple of years to reach a threshold amount for both the CRV and the deed tax that worked best for the department's needs with respect to the sales ratio study, and also for the counties collecting deed tax and being able to check records on the CRV to know what they should base the deed tax calculation on. And that concludes Article 2.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chelsea Griffin, and I'm a staff attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'll be walking you through the provisions of Article 3. Section 1 clarifies that the Commissioner of Revenue may collect property tax data at the parcel level or higher at the time and in the form and manner as specified by the Commissioner. This language reflects the implementation of the Property Record Information System of Minnesota, which is the department's current system for collecting property tax data. Sections 2 through 19, with the exception of Section 11, strike references to abstract level reports, as this is no longer the format that the department receives this information. Section 20 is a repealer that repeals the language describing the abstract of tax lists. Again, this is not needed if Section 1 is enacted, since the department no longer receives abstract level reports of property tax data. And Section 11 clarifies that for a fractional agricultural homestead, it would receive a fractional agricultural homestead market value credit amount.
All right. We have an amendment before us, label A19. Who is offering this? Representative Hertas?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's pretty much agreeable that everything as put forth was non-controversial, with the exception of this Article 11 as discussed last session. And we had a number of county assessors come, as well as gentlemen from the Association of Counties, testify that in most rural counties, the manner in which the homestead credit has been applied as a matter of percentage of ownership of the homestead. And what the department's proposed non-controversial change was to change what farmers had been receiving as a fractional homestead to number of owners into 100, basically assigning homestead credit to people who wouldn't necessarily live on the farm, and denying the actual operator of the farm the full, and who's residing on the farm, the full homestead credit. So we did have a bill that was part of the omnibus tax bill last year, and this amendment clarifies that the manner in calculating the homestead credit will be a matter of what's recorded in the deed in the county recorder's office, and if that information is not available or it's too difficult for the assessor to obtain that information, then it defaults to the way the department wants, where it's number of owners into 100. So that pretty much summarizes the amendment.
Okay. Any discussions to the amendment? Representative Jaskowski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess I have a question for the author. I understood the bill really contained only items that were in the conference committee report, and Representative Hertas talking about the discussion from last session. We did have a very long discussion with all the major players on this, and it was adopted going out of committee here. So I don't know that the language in your bill was actually part of the conference committee report, or was it? Maybe somebody can correct me there, but I don't think, Madam Chair, this was actually the language in your bill was part of the conference committee report.
Chair Lawler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Jaskowski. We asked the nonpartisan staff to look at all the provisions that had been brought before the full body, and they included this. Now we've had some change in staff, so if this the intention was for this to be a bill that was totally non-controversial, and it only came to my attention late last week that this section had some differing opinions on, and my thought was originally to just delete it from the bill as a result and have a separate hearing on the topic, but I heard from both yourself and Representative Hertas that you preferred to have the discussion as an amendment, and so I allowed that to go through in respect to the two of you.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Chair Loeffler, I'm wondering, so the bill itself and all of its elements, were they pieces that were brought before the committee last year, or were they pieces that passed out of the committee to the tax committee, or were they pieces that the tax committee adopted, or were they pieces that were adopted in the conference committee? Because I understood when I signed on to the bill that they were all part of the conference committee report.
Madam Chair. Chair Lothar. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I'll let Ms. Hagler address this. It was my intention that this be a collection of non-controversial provisions that had passed in the last term. But she can explain how the process by which it was assembled from a variety of provisions.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, in compiling both this bill and the next bill, we took provisions that were in 4835, the tax omnibus bill from last year, and also the conference committee report. So these are all provisions that you have seen from last year.
So,
Representative Drakowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So maybe I don't know how this language got into the conference committee report. I don't know. I'm perplexed, but thank you.
Chair Loeffler. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a problem with the proposal of the option that's in this amendment, but I had told Representative Hertaus if it got into an extended debate, we would probably schedule a separate hearing, but I don't see a lot of consternation here, and we'll continue as we go in the months ahead to always be open to feedback from all the parties that are involved.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Loeffler, thank you for that comment, and thank you for working with me on this last week.
Ms. Schell?
Madam Chair and members, I have brought my entire folder from 435 from the conference committee. And actually, this particular provision was in Article 15, Subdivision 11, and approved on 511.
Representative Hertaus, do you want to move your amendment, A19?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move the A1 amendment.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. I believe we have someone from the public that wishes to testify on the bill. Regarding, what's that? 632, right? Jeffrey Strand, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe I just misquoted the number of the amendment. The amendment is the A19-0009 amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Vang and Chair Loeffler. I'm Jeffrey Strand. I'm here today for the Minnesota Association of County Officers and the Minnesota Association of County Auditor, Treasurer, and Finance Officers, MCATFO. And so while I'm employed with Hennepin County as an administrative manager, and I manage the delinquent property tax enforcement and collections tax forfeiture program, as well as the Human Service Navigator to prevent forfeitures, and tax processing. But today I'm here for MACO and MCATFO. And I'd like to thank the chair and the authors of the bill and Republican lead Hertaus for the opportunity to speak today in favor of the provision in House File 632. I'm referring to Article 1, Section 4, related to the conveyance and fee. And so, just by way of background, I co-chair the MCATFO Statewide Delinquency and Tax Forfeiture Committee with approximately 25 members from 20-plus counties, from St. Louis to Lyon, from Wabasha, Olmsted to Roseau. And so we have a quite diverse committee makeup. And I co-chair that with Heather Bessler from Olmsted County, who couldn't be here today. And our committee met in October 2018 and reiterated its support for this item as a priority item, that it be included in the 2019 MACO platform, as well as the top 12 list, which it is number 6 in the MACO top 12 list. And the provision in Article 1, Section 4 is essential to implement your 2017 law changes related to alternate tax forfeited land sale provisions, including the option for using real estate brokers. Many counties are interested in this new law. Hennepin County may be the first county in the state that has implemented the new law and, in fact, has three broker sales pending, one cash and two with financing in Crystal, Golden Valley, and North Minneapolis, along with a pending sale with the City of Lakes Community Land Trust to provide perpetual affordable housing. Maaco and McCatfo appreciate the support in 2018 with House File 3501 that was later merged into other larger bills. And I appreciate Representative Paul Anderson's support in testifying with him last March. We believe that these changes will help normalize and open up tax forfeited land home sales to regular home buyers, those who may be intimidated in attending a land auction venue with 100 bidders selling properties to simply the highest bidder. And it's crucial to have a recordable conveyance instrument present at the closing to avoid much complicated workaround steps and to avoid need for gap title insurance coverage to protect lenders providing financing of home purchasing. And so again, this makes the tax forfeited land home sales, which in my professional experience is dealing with renovated homes based on a targeted contracting for small business, minority, and women contractor program, to make this more available to regular people like all of us to buy homes. And so we did note the earlier effective date would be ideal because there are properties out there waiting to be moved. And I really thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of the provision in House File 632.
Thank you, Mrs. Strand. Chair Loeffler?
Yeah. And with that, I'd like to again move that this be laid over House File 632 for possible inclusion in the division report.
Well, before that, I forgot to ask, is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify? All right. Representative Drakowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for the author. Chair Loeffler, Article 1, Section 2 does regard private data, and that's a data practices provision. Will this bill eventually go to the Civil Law Committee?
Chair Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Drazkowski. I will confer as to whether or not they considered that last year and whether or not our Data Privacy Committee would like to see it again.
All right, and with that, Chair Loeffler renews her motion that House File 632 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division port and that House File is laid over as amended. Members, you do have quite a few items. What's that? Okay. All right. We do have another bill on the agenda, House File 567. Chair Loeffler, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move House File 567 be brought before the committee and be considered for possible inclusion in the division report, and I would also like to have the committee consider the addition of the H0567A1 author's amendment.
All right, we have the bill before us. Chair Loeffler offers the author's amendment to House File 567, label A1. Would you like to move your amendment?
I so move.
All right, Chair Loeffler moves A1 amendment. Does everyone have the amendment? Chair Loeffler? Can you briefly describe what your amendment does?
Thank you. Yes, this just clarifies a couple of implementation dates and then brings into this bill provisions that were in the earlier bill that have some cost implications so that the cost items are clustered together in one bill just to make it easier for us to track as the bill goes forward and we assemble our final division report. It has to do with the provisions that cost money, and this have to do with the Cloquet Area Fire and Ambulance Taxing District Board and some fire relief for communities that were devastated by fires in the recent past.
All right. Is there any discussions? Representative Rumbach?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just am curious why it seems like a unique circumstance in this particular fire district. I mean, the cost of providing fire or ambulance services, are you going to be removing that then from the city budget entirely?
Chair Lawler?
Is that the movement that's happening here?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that in this scarcely populated area of the state, it's a regional service, not, and that it needs a special taxing authority to cover the entire region that is served by this fire and ambulance service. So it serves more than one community because it needs to. It's not possible for all the small communities in that area to operate their own, and so they collectively have come to us at the legislature to say they'd like to be able to work together. And in funding this service rather than having to do all separate levies and compete it together and do lots of different reporting, that it's much more efficient for them, and it's been done in the past.
Representative Hewitt?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, this is my space. This is really an important funding mechanism for these smaller communities. Not only do they got to look at their own budgets, but they also have to go out, and this is hard for them to do, but this is really a good mechanism the state put in a few years ago, and I'm on the bill. I support it. So did that answer your question, I hope?
Representative Jarkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Mr. Swanson can comment, but we have one fire protection district in Minnesota, and it's this one. It's Cloquet. They've had this fire protection district since 2009 or so, and so they have some history behind them. There were multiple bills that came forward last year to want to create additional fire districts around the state, so certainly this committee is going to be probably hearing or seeing, or certainly you're going to be visited about them in your office by people promoting them. One of the things we brought up last year is what does it cost with these fire protection districts compared to not having them, and certainly we'll have that discussion. But I think the chair's bill, Representative Rumbach, only just takes the existing language and then allows it to include fire or ambulance services, and that's really what's included in this provision.
Chair Lawler?
Thank you. I think that was a good explanation, and I appreciate the former chair of the division giving us some additional details and background. And so any
further discussions or questions? All right. Hearing none, those in favor of the motion by signifying, saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Lawler, to your bill.
Thank you. And I'm going to have Mr. Swanson again from House Research just quickly have us go through the collection of items within this consolidated bill as well.
Thank you. Please identify yourself to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jared Swanson from House Research. And like Ms. Hagler, I'll just walk through this bill section by section. Section one of the bill is it increases the amount of property eligible for a property tax exemption for agricultural and historical societies. That current acreage limit is 20, and this would increase that limit to 40. Section 2 of the bill is a property tax exemption for a pharmacy in Minneapolis that is owned by a federally recognized Indian tribe. Section 3 of the bill moves the application deadline for the Disabled Veterans Homestead exclusion from July 1st to December 15th. Section 4 of the bill is also a section that moves an application date, and this one is for the senior deferral program. It moves the application deadline from July 1st back to November 1st, and it also clarifies that the taxpayer can request early notification of approval or denial from the program. Sections 5 through 9 deal with the Cloquet Area Fire and Ambulance Special Taxing District, and like what we just heard, this is a district that was established back in 2009, and I believe at the time the intent of the language was to allow this special taxing district to the ability to have bonding authority. And then I think it was about in 2016 when they actually went to the bonding agencies to issue bonds to build a new building. They found out that they needed some clarification in the law. So this this section does that, or these sections, 5 through 9, do that. Section 10 of the bill reallocates some money that was appropriated to the city of Melrose in 2017. And Section 10 is also for one of the fires that Representative Loeffler mentioned. And Section 11 of the bill appropriates $2,600 to the city of Mazeppa and $2,400 to Wabasha County to reimburse them for property tax abatements that resulted from a fire in March of 2018. And that concludes the bill.
All right, thank you. Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Swanson. A question in regards to our tax revenue, our estimate here from the Department of Revenue. When we talk about some of the property tax exemptions for the Historical Society and the Indian Tribe pharmacies and so forth, it says negligible, which is the state portion of that. Do we know how much the impact is to the counties and cities that would be exempted from collecting property tax? And the reason why I ask that is because I'm becoming more and more sensitive to a lot of the litigation out there and appeals based upon what is considered the dark store appeal process, in which counties are getting hit more and more with having to reduce property tax base without receiving any additional revenue. And so I'm always concerned about whether or not these exemptions, how they impact the local counties and cities. So do we have any idea what that cost might be?
Mr. Swanson? Ms. Schell?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, if you take a look at the revenue estimate on page 2, for example, the Agricultural Historical Society exemption, it talks about how approximately 10 parcels would be impacted by this particular change. And so that's why you see the revenue impact listed as negligible. And for those who are unfamiliar with the negligible label, it means the impact is $5,000 or less. And then similarly, with respect to the property tax exemption on the pharmacy owned by an Indian tribe, it is for that particular property. Now, you are right, Representative Petersburg, that when you have an exemption that shifts the property tax burden onto other properties, and what you see reflected here is the property tax refund impact on homestead property. So the entire impact as it happens, when that shift happens, is not reflected totally here. Only what is reflected here is how it impacts a state fund.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you. And yes, I'm aware of that. But the redistribution of the wealth and then the tax base then creates tax increases for the remaining properties that are there. And so it's not something it's an even wash. I mean, there is some cost to that. So I'm just curious on the cost. So thank you for that.
All right. Is there anyone? Chair Loeffler, do you have?
Oh, I was just going to say, I remember the discussion from last year, and there were lots of local people in support of this bill who wanted to be able to demonstrate more modern farming techniques that needed a little more space to be able to do that. So there were local government officials testifying in support of it at that time. So I assume that represents community support.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify on House File 567? All right. Any further discussions? And with that, Chair Loeffler renews her motion that House File 567 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report, and that House files laid over as amended.
Thank you very much.
Yes, and with that, that's the last item of our agenda, and so meeting is adjourned.